This is Radio Sputnik.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
It's 4 p.m. in London, 11 a.m. in Washington, Miami and New York, and it's 7 p.m. in Moscow. This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. Coming up on today's programme, Iranian President Hassan Rouhani has dismissed Donald Trump's immigration and travel ban during a speech in which he called the US president a, quote, political novice. The announcement comes on the same day that Iran has admitted to testing new missiles. However, there are those who have been questioning why Iran was put on the travel ban list in the first place. On today's show, we'll be looking into that and the consequences that this could have on US-Iran relations in greater detail. Human rights groups have raised concerns after an announcement from the Bangladeshi government which could see tens of thousands of refugees fleeing Myanmar, relocating to a remote island 9 hours away. The island is currently only used by pirates and is flooded for several months of the year. We'll be speaking to Human Rights Watch about the plight of the Rohingya Muslims fleeing Myanmar. A think tank study has found that inequality in the UK is set to be at its greatest level for decades. The Resolution Foundation's warnings chime with other forecasts which paint a gloomy picture for the British economy. We hear directly from the think tank this hour. The rat-infested conditions in which 38,000 asylum seekers are housed in Britain have been branded as disgraceful by MPs. It's led to an influential Westminster committee calling for a major overhaul of the system. With just under 3 weeks to go until Ecuador's general elections, the first one at which the unprecedentedly popular President Rafael Correa will not be standing. And today we'll be taking a look ahead at the runners and riders and what it all means for Ecuador. And online dating has found a new market. Yes, apparently now orangutans have their very own Tinder. All that and more over the next hour on this Wednesday edition of World in Focus. As the debate over President Donald Trump's travel ban rages on, leaders around the world continue to express their consternation. Iranian President Rouhani is the latest to join the chorus of condemnation, suggesting that US President Donald Trump's executive order to ban refugees and those travelling from 7 Muslim-majority states was a decision based on incompetence. It's likely that Rouhani's comments are also born of a concern that the Trump administration is going to take a much tougher line on Iran than the Obama administration. Trump has already suggested renegotiating the terms of the landmark nuclear deal that was signed between the world powers and Tehran in 2015. For more on this, here is Matthew Wayton.
The president of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Hassan Rouhani, has hit back at his US counterpart Donald Trump by calling him a political novice, stepping up the criticism of his immigration ban, which includes a temporary travel ban on Iranians. Rouhani added about Trump that, quote, he is new to politics, he has been in a different world, it's a totally new environment to him, it will take him a long time and will cost the United States a lot until he learns what is happening in the world. Trump defended his executive order that was signed on Friday, saying that it was needed to protect US national security interests. Iran was one of the 7 countries affected by Trump's travel ban, which includes Syria, Iran, Iraq, Yemen, Somalia, Sudan, and Libya. President Trump has also promised to take a tougher stance on Iran, condemning the nuclear deal which was signed between Washington, the world powers, and Iran, calling it, quote, the worst deal ever negotiated. Concern has arisen that Trump's confrontational approach toward Iran may stymie Rouhani's efforts to attract foreign investors. There is concern that Trump's policy toward Iran may also slow the sale of 80 Boeing jets and 100 Airbuses that were signed last year. There are those, however, who have questioned the reason for Iran's place within Trump's travel ban. Iran is the only country out of the 7 that is not embroiled in some kind of civil war, and unlike the other countries, does not have an Al-Qaeda or Daesh presence. Well, to try and shed some light on why that might be, we are joined by Nada Habibi, a professor of economics of the Middle East at Brandeis University. Professor, thank you very much for your time. Why has the Trump administration included Iran in this list? Of course, Iranian immigration to the US really slowed down into the 1990s, and the country has not been used as a major safe haven or retreat of any kind for any kind of group like Daesh or Al-Qaeda. So what are the reasons, do you think?
I think there are two reasons. One of them is the legacy of a number of steps that Obama administration took. And the other one is the overall perception of the Trump administration towards Iran and how it wants to manage the relationships with Iran moving forward. President Obama, in December of 2015, imposed a ban on nationals of visa waiver countries that have visited a number of countries, including Iran. It was not a ban on travel by Iranian citizens, but by, for example, Europeans who might have visited Iran and several other countries since 2011. Now, Trump administration took that ban, which included seven countries, Iran one of them, and said, we want to impose a ban on travels of the nationals of these countries to the United States. It was a significant expansion, and it was really different from the original intention of the restriction that Obama administration imposed. So this, I think, was part of the promise to increase the vetting and restrictions on movement of people to the United States, primarily in response to a number of terrorist attacks in Europe and the United States. More than that, I think this is the inclusion of Iran is also part of the perception of the Republicans and the right-wing pressure groups, political groups in the United States, that the Trump administration should put more pressure on Iran. And the Trump administration has announced that it wants to also renegotiate the nuclear agreement that was achieved in late 2015. And went into effect in January 2016.
Of course, the Bush administration was well known for taking a tough stance toward Iran. Do you think that this is just a continuation of those neoconservative attitudes, or is this something different altogether?
I believe some of the intentions and perceptions are similar, in the sense that the groups and individuals who are interested in further increasing the tensions between Iran and the United States, and also to imposing more pressure on Iran in order to alter Iran's policy in the region, are encouraging Trump administration to adopt a more aggressive policy towards Iran. It's not just limited to concern about Iran's nuclear program, but also Iran's foreign policy in the region, including Iran's cooperation with Russia in Syria, for example. Also, Iran's development of Iran's missile program. Just recently, Iran tested a ballistic missile, and I anticipate that there would be a lot of concern and criticism and reaction by Trump administration in the coming days towards that test.
Just moving on, Iranian President Hassan Rouhani has obviously been trying to open Iran's economy to foreign investment, especially since the nuclear agreement with the world powers was signed. Do you think that this initiative will now be damaged?
Yes. Foreign investors who are looking for investment opportunities in Iran are very sensitive to how the United States is going to react and develop its policy towards Iran, because the United States has the capability to impose additional sanctions unilaterally and also to punish any corporations that deal with Iran. There are, because the U.S. market is so important to many large corporations, they would be hesitant to invest in Iran if they think that because of those investments they might be punished or they might lose access to U.S. market. So I think investors are watching this, and this is why the Iranian government is also very sensitive and is trying to assess the damage that this might cause, especially Rouhani administration that has supported the agreement and is facing an election, a presidential election in a few months.
Yes, and a lot of commentators are now saying that with Trump's hardline stance vis-a-vis Iran, the hardline figures in the Iranian government will finally be able to overcome the more moderate Hassan Rouhani. Do you think that that's an accurate assessment?
It all depends on how the Trump administration manages the nuclear agreement. I don't think that's definite to say that they would be emboldened. It depends on really what Trump administration does. And as long as there is no perception that Iran itself was at fault for any kind of disruption to the agreement, I'm not sure how it can be benefiting the hardliners. Obviously, it would be damaging to Rouhani's position if the entire agreement is derailed, because then the hardliners would say, we told you from beginning that the United States cannot be trusted.
Yes, and of course, that's where the big question mark really hangs, isn't it, over the Iran nuclear deal. Trump has said that he plans to enforce it rigorously, but then at the same time, he's also called it the, quote, worst deal ever. So what outcome do you think is most likely?
I think he said that he he wants to renegotiate it, which means that, in my opinion, he wants to add additional restrictions and demand additional modifications in Iran's behavior on non-nuclear issues, including Iran's missile development program and Iran's foreign policy. I believe that would be resisted, but there is a likelihood that he will move in this direction because of his support base and the foreign policy interest groups that advocate imposing more pressure on Iran, including Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel, who has openly said that he will lobby Trump administration for additional pressures on Iran and modification of the nuclear agreement.
Okay, Professor. Well, thank you very much for your time.
You're most welcome.
Matthew Eaton for World in Focus.
You're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. It's just coming up for 11 minutes past the hour. The government of Bangladesh has sparked debate by resurrecting a plan to relocate thousands of refugees to an island in the Bay of Bengal. Thingar Char lies 18 miles off the coast of Hatia Island, a nine-hour journey from the camps where the Rohingya refugees have taken shelter. Some reports suggest that Bangladesh is keen to clear the area, which is currently home to the refugees, as it's a prominent holiday destination. But could this be a call for help in dealing with the influx of refugees fleeing persecution in Myanmar? Carolyn Scott has this report.
Figures from the UN Refugee Agency suggest that around 65,000 Rohingya Muslims have fled from the Rakhine State in Myanmar since October of last year, when the Myanmar military began a fresh crackdown. But Rohingya Muslims have been fleeing the region for years, many travelling to neighbouring Bangladesh. The Rohingya Muslim minority is not recognised by the Myanmar government as being an official ethnic group of the country, and since the crackdown in October, harrowing accounts have been released of the abuse that many have faced. Now the government of Bangladesh has brought back a plan to relocate the refugees that have fled over the border to a remote island in the Bay of Bengal. The island is marshland, which appeared in the bay over the last several years as a build-up of sediment. A development plan was put in place to attempt to make the island more habitable, but currently it is known as an island synonymous with pirates who take advantage of its remote location. Earlier I spoke with Phil Robertson, the Deputy Director of the Asia Division for Human Rights Watch, and I began by asking him for some clarity on the extent of the situation with those fleeing Myanmar.
The situation is one where there's approximately 300,000 refugees from Myanmar who are ethnic Rohingya who have fled the most horrible sorts of abuses in Myanmar. The wave of 65,000 that has arrived since October is part of that, and they're fleeing instances of extrajudicial executions, wholesale burning of their communities, rape of their women, just horrific stuff. And they've now fled into Bangladesh. They're joining a group of people who have fled previous pogroms in Myanmar and been residents in Bangladesh in some cases for decades. There are people grouped in large camps with very little humanitarian support. I mean, the issues of sanitation, food, education, service, all these things are really very touch and go for these group of people who are in Bangladesh, but at least they're safe. But now the Bangladesh government has other ideas, and it's talking about moving them to an island, which is unsuitable for human habitation.
I mean, it's understandable that logistically Bangladesh will find it very difficult to deal with an influx of, as you say, several hundred thousand people. Is there any help being given to Bangladesh to try and find an alternative to this island?
Well, there is help being given to these groups of people who are based in Cox's Bazar. There's international NGOs there. There's a UN refugee agency, UNHCR, present. The International Organization for Migration is also helping out. So there is international assistance reaching Bangladesh. The problem is that Bangladesh doesn't like where they are. They've been in these camps in Cox's Bazar, in some cases, the original group going back to 1992. And the government of Bangladesh has always been eager to move them. The question is, move them to where? And now, for the second time in the past several years, this island idea has come up. And we're talking about moving as many as 300,000 people 9 hours away to an island which floods during the monsoon, which is wholly inhabitable. And one official said, well, the only people out there are pirates, who find the inaccessibility a part of their trade.
There has been a development plan, I believe, in attempting to make the island habitable by planting trees and so on. Do you think that there is any chance that, this island could be made habitable in such a way?
I think if they had another decade, perhaps. But, you know, if you're looking at global warming, these are the sort of areas that are at first at risk. Bangladesh is a low-lying country, and it's entirely susceptible to rising oceans. So when you're talking about putting people on an island that submerges for a significant part of the year, you know, what happens if a monsoon comes in? The monsoon would just wipe people out if they're on those islands, which are, you know, basically mud flats, you know, in the middle of a river. It's a bad idea any way you look at it, and it won't be a voluntary movement. They would have to force people to go there, and, you know, that goes against the principle of the way you treat refugees.
Yeah, it does seem to, certainly to me, it makes me think of the detention centres we see on Nauru and on Manus Island, which have, of course, been the centre of a lot of controversy, and they were referred to as offshore prison centres, because once people were there, the refugees we spoke to there said, we felt like we could flee our home country, but now we are imprisoned on an island miles away from everyone. Do you think that it would be a similar situation, that these people could just be forced there and could end up just feeling as if they are living in a prison?
Well, I think they would be imprisoned by the location, since it's so remote. And without a boat, you wouldn't be able to go anywhere. You know, the question is what the Rohingya would do there. You know, how would people provide assistance there? You know, would they be provided with boats to be able to go fishing, for instance? If the answer is no, then there's no way for them to survive unless, you know, you get constant humanitarian assistance provided. And if it's an involuntary movement, I think a lot of the international donors would be reluctant to be involved in any way. So, you know, it's a bad idea. It's a bad plan. It hasn't been fully thought through by the Bangladesh government. They're just trying to react to deal with the problem in front of them, which they think is they've got too many Rohingya in their front yard. But, you know, this sort of thing needs to be planned, and it can't just be sort of put together by fiat from the top of the government and everything is expected to fall into place. It's just not going to work that way. And I think if you're talking about moving such a large number of people in an involuntary way, it's going to be a humanitarian disaster.
There has been a lot of response to this over the last 24 hours. Do you think that the Bangladeshi government are likely to take this into account and to perhaps rethink, or are they going to listen to people like Human Rights Watch who are raising concerns here?
Well, they may not listen to us. We're not the most popular NGO there, but we believe that the various governments that are donor partners of Bangladesh, as well as the international agencies, will have a lot of sway. I interpret this a little bit as Bangladesh asking for more assistance and support. But I think that if they actually try to go forward with this, as I said, this is going to be a human rights and humanitarian disaster, because people will not want to go. It will not be safe for them to go, and they will be basically put on mud flats in the middle of a river. You know, what sort of plan is that? This is not the way you treat refugees. You know, I think that ultimately Bangladesh has the right to ask for help from the international community, but it also has a responsibility to protect these people and not put their lives at risk by, you know, putting them on a flooding island.
Well, Phil Robertson, thank you so much for joining us today. It's good to have your view on it all.
Sure, thank you so much.
Phil Robertson, Deputy Director of the Asia Division of Human Rights Watch, talking to me earlier about the potential relocation of Rohingya Muslim refugees to an island in the Bay of Bengal. Carolyn Scott for World in Focus.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Coming up on the programme, two protesters who breached security at BAE Systems manufacturing facility in England before damaging fighter jets destined for Saudi Arabia have exposed weaknesses in the protection of Britain's key military assets. We'll have a report from a senior security expert. That and more in just a few minutes.
Radio Sputnik.
Mainstream news coverage catches the big moments.
60 people confirmed dead.
Brexit means Brexit.
We will make America great again.
But what about the stories behind the stories?
The untold stories hidden beneath the mainstream.
Several hundred guys on voluntary starvation.
Intelligence agencies cannot admit they make a mistake.
If they tell me back, I will be killed myself.
Sputnik's daily global current affairs programme, World in Focus, with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Join us live from Sputnik Studios in Edinburgh, Scotland, every weekday from 4 p.m. in the UK, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, and 7 o'clock in Moscow.
Hey, this is Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist,
troublemaker, and muckraker from bradblog.com.
Join me for the Bradcast. Every day, right here on Radio Sputnik, we'll have investigative interviews with newsmakers.
We'll call out the liars, frauds, and phonies, and we'll even give kudos to the good guys.
when and if we find any. Stories and ideas you won't hear anywhere else. Join me, Brad Friedman, for the Bradcast every day right here on Radio Sputnik.
On Sputnik with Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert. Tune in!
Well, maybe mention like central bankers and you know, markets are doubling down. Not, you're saying everybody's doubling down. They're crazy.
They are. Everyone's crazy.
Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Oddly enough, it's not nonfiction books that seem to animate the right. It's novels, because this vision of America that comes out of the right is something that you have to make up. You know, it's not like you could write a book saying, oh, here's a right-wing country that works really well. Let's emulate them.
This is the Tom Hartman Program
on Radio Sputnik.
Tune in to Loud and Clear with Brian Becker for the latest news, commentary, and political analysis. What's really behind the political and social crisis gripping the United States and the world? Forget the spoon-fed soundbites from the pundits who know so little about so much. We bring you independent experts, analysts, and activists. Learn what really makes the decision-makers take from the boardrooms of Wall Street to the West Wing of the White House. Here is where the people fighting for change speak and are heard loud and clear. 5 days a week on Radio Sputnik and SputnikNews.com.
Hard Facts is a show that gets to the heart of the matter. We question the mainstream media narrative to get to the truth about world affairs.
I don't think they have a clue what they're doing in Syria.
Basically, it's the sixth attempt by the big powers to overthrow a Middle East government.
Whether it is regime change masked as revolution, imperialism masked as democracy and human rights, on Hard Facts, we peel back the layers to get to the real story other media doesn't want you to hear.
Absolutely astonishing the British government reacted to this case simply by lying.
Hard Facts.
Radio Sputnik. We speak your language. Find us at SputnikNews.com.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, two protesters who breached security at BAE Systems manufacturing facility in England before damaging fighter jets destined for Saudi Arabia have exposed weaknesses in the protection of Britain's key military assets. We'll have a report from a senior security expert in just a moment. A think tank study has found that inequality in the UK is set to be at its greatest level for decades. The Resolution Foundation's warnings chime with other forecasts which paint a gloomy picture for the British economy. We hear directly from the think tank this hour, and online dating has found a new market. Apparently, orangutans now have their very own Tinder. It's 23 minutes past the hour. You're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. They are the most critical and expensive military assets in the UK's arsenal. So how did two protesters, one a Methodist preacher, manage to circumvent security at Britain's top arms manufacturer before causing serious criminal damage to one of the most advanced fighter jets ever built? Well, our reporter Mark Hurst has this.
Two protesters have been charged with causing criminal damage whilst trying to disarm and prevent Eurofighter Typhoons built at BAE Systems facility in Lancashire, England, from being supplied to Saudi Arabia. In a statement published on social media, the two men, the Reverend Dan Woodhouse, a Methodist minister, and Sam Walton, a Quaker, claimed their actions would save lives and prevent weapons being used against civilians in Yemen. The Saudis are currently embroiled in a bitter conflict in the Arabian Peninsula and have faced increased criticism that their actions in Yemen are deliberately targeting civilian populations. But does this incident also raise concerns over the level of security around key military infrastructure in the UK and the potential for terrorists rather than protesters to easily carry out an attack against a military target? Dr. Julian Richards is a senior lecturer in security studies at the University of Buckingham's Centre for Security and Intelligence Studies, and earlier I asked him if he was surprised at the apparent ease in which these protesters managed to get access to the aircraft.
Yes, I am slightly surprised. The UK doesn't actually have a strong tradition of
protest and sabotage at military sites compared to some countries. This sort of thing is relatively rare, and that can possibly lead to complacency in some cases and mean that some of these facilities are maybe not as secure as they ought to be. So this was a bit of a wake-up call, I think, for these sorts of sites, that this type of thing can happen. So, yes, I was slightly surprised that they managed to get in and cause, you know, quite expensive damage in the way that they did.
And I appreciate this incident took place at BAE Systems, the manufacturer, rather than a specific military site, but everyone assumes that military equipment like fighter aircraft and submarines have exceptional levels of security around them, but there are clearly gaps in security. Is this latest incident likely to see the MOD and BAE Systems review security arrangements to better guard against this kind of action?
Yes, it is. Both sides will be taking this very, very seriously, and it will trigger all sorts of investigations and inquiries and thoughts about how to make sure this sort of thing doesn't happen in the future. I mean, generally, it's just because BAE Systems is a private contractor. They generally work very, very closely with the MOD, and on the sensitive technologies on which they're working, they will take a lot of care, and there will be a lot of thought goes into securing these facilities appropriately. So it wouldn't be right to say that BAE Systems are slightly more cavalier than the MOD themselves would be, because they work so closely together that they're hand in glove on these things. But nevertheless, there are always risks where you have private contractors working on equipment or systems that there could be chinks in the armour. So this sort of incident will certainly have triggered a big investigation.
And as you mentioned, these kinds of incidents are quite rare, but it's not the first time protesters have managed to come close to being able to sabotage hugely strategically important military assets in the UK. It was recently revealed that Margaret Thatcher, the former UK Prime Minister, had authorised the MOD to shoot dead any protesters who were at risk of sabotaging any of the UK's nuclear submarines after protesters had managed to enter a submarine and even gain access to the sub's control room. Are there other less lethal methods in which security might be deployed to prevent such breaches?
Yes, and I mean, it's fair to say that when Margaret Thatcher was in power, it was the height of the Cold War, where we all had operational nuclear facilities in place and we were on war readiness footings and so on. So the whole climate and the atmosphere was rather different from today, although obviously we do have nuclear submarines still today. But we have to be careful about sort of comparisons. But yes, of course, no government, particularly a liberal democracy, wants to be seen shooting protesters dead. That would be the last thing they would want to have happen. So there are a number of other measures that would be considered. I mean, the most important and obvious one is making sure that even if you have a number of layers of physical security on your site, so even if protesters manage to break into the site, they can only get so far into the site before they hit some sort of further barrier or further fence or defensive system. I mean, we had an example of protesters who broke into the Menwith Hill satellite earth station site on the North Yorkshire Moors a few years ago and managed to get into the outer defences and actually into some buildings. But those buildings there are several rings of classification as you go through the site. So the buildings that they got into were largely administrative buildings and they didn't get right into the sort of control room. So the design of these sites is usually such that even if there is a breach of the outer defences, protesters or saboteurs hopefully won't be able to get too far in.
And although there has been criminal damage done in this latest incident, in some ways it's a bit of a let-off for those at BAE Systems. This could have been much more sinister. This could have been a terrorist attack with perhaps far more darker consequences.
Well, indeed, and that's why these incidents are so interesting and important in a way, because as you say, if fairly low-level protesters, I think one of these chaps was a reverend who's very opposed on sort of peace grounds to what's going on. If somebody like that can get in and get right up to a fighter jet and do something to it, then who's to say that somebody couldn't get in and plant an explosive device on it? So that's why they'll be looking at this very closely, not so much from what actually happened in this case, but from what it shows could happen on a much more serious level.
Dr. Julian Richards, many thanks for joining us on World in Focus today.
This is World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. It's just gone 29 minutes past the hour. A study by a respected think tank has found that inequality in the United Kingdom is set to be at its greatest level for decades. The Resolution Foundation's warnings chime with other forecasts for a squeeze on family budgets due to poor wage growth, welfare cuts, rising global oil prices, and the pound's sharp fall since the Brexit vote. The study found that the current parliament would be the worst for living standards for the poorest half of households since comparable records began in the mid-1960s. Liam O'Hare has more.
So is Britain heading back to the inequality not seen since the days of Margaret Thatcher? Well, earlier I was joined by Stephen Clark, who's the research and policy analyst with the think tank behind the report. I asked him to explain the findings.
We did some research that looked at living standards both today and how they're going to evolve in the next few years. And our research shows that although the UK has experienced somewhat of a mini boom in living standards in the last couple of years, in the next few years we're going to see living standards slow down and possibly decline for some groups. And we find that there's going to be a big rise in inequality as incomes grow more for those at the top while they shrink for those at the bottom.
Of course, the Treasury says, as you mentioned, that living standards actually reached the highest level ever last year. Is that not something to take on board, that there is actually some positive signs when it comes to the British economy?
Yeah, indeed. And as our research also shows, as I said, there's been a somewhat of a mini boom in living standards and household incomes have just returned to the level that they were before the crisis. So although it's true that they are now at their highest level, they are nowhere near the level they would be if they'd have continued to grow as they were before the crisis during it. So we do have to remember that, you know, the financial crisis had a big effect. However, I think the more worrying thing is that what we've done is look forward towards the next few years, and that's where the challenges will really lie. And we know that inflation is on the rise, and we know that although employment is high, it's not growing like it was, and we know that in the next few years significant welfare cuts are scheduled. And all these three factors together mean that income growth is likely to slow for most families, and it may fall for many in the bottom half.
How much is the uncertainty caused by the Brexit vote going to affect the economy? Is it too early to say, or do you believe that that could have a negative effect on equality in the UK?
Our research doesn't directly look at the effects of Brexit in the sense that the wider effects of the vote to leave the European Union are not clear and probably won't be clear for a number of years. What we do find, though, is that inflation is on the rise and it is forecast to continue to rise, and that is partly the result of the decline in the value of the pound, which occurred after the referendum. So that effect of Brexit is a big part of our forecast, but the wider effects that may occur as a result of leaving the European Union, as we and no one really knows, we haven't factored that in.
How much is Britain still, or the British economy, still imbalanced, particularly when it comes to geographical imbalance, and so much of the wealth is concentrated around the south and southeast of the country? And how big a factor is that when it comes to inequality?
Well, in the report, we do look regionally as well as at people at different levels of income. And we find that the southeast is still the wealthiest region, and there are many regions which lag that significantly. So the northeast and Northern Ireland, household incomes are about 20% less than they are in the southeast. In other cases, in particularly Scotland's case, and there has been a bit of a catching up between Scotland and the southeast over the last couple of decades. But the gaps that exist, by and large, for most regions haven't narrowed. So most are still relatively poor compared to the southeast. And obviously addressing these regional divergences are just as important as addressing the differences between households.
And just lastly, it's obviously quite a bleak picture that's been painted by the report in the sense when it comes to inequality. What measures would the Resolution Foundation or yourself believe could actually help, and indeed not, we wouldn't see such a kind of worsening state of affairs when it comes to inequality in the UK?
This piece of work is a projection, it is a prediction, and therefore, you know, as predictions can be, it could be wrong, and if it is wrong, it's likely to be wrong because there's good reasons, because perhaps employment continues to grow as rapidly as it has done, and that will involve, you know, the government working hard to entice more people into the labour market, perhaps those such as disabled people who face significant barriers to working often. It could be that pay rises quicker than we expect, but this will involve dealing with the chronic productivity problem the country has and has had for the last decade. So, you know, if we can raise productivity, we can change this picture. And finally, perhaps most directly in the government's hands, is that the current government has inherited plans to reduce spending on welfare, which was inherited from the Cameron government. And obviously those plans can be reevaluated, and there could be some redistribution in the sense that the current tax cuts that are planned could be shelved, and instead some of the money could be used to ameliorate the impact of the welfare cuts that will affect lower income households.
Stephen Clark, it was great to get your thoughts. Thanks so much for joining us on World in Focus.
Thank you very much.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Coming up on the programme, the rat-infested conditions in which 38,000 asylum seekers are housed in Britain have been branded disgraceful by members of the UK Parliament, and it's led to an influential Westminster committee calling for a major overhaul of the system. That's in just a few minutes.
This is Radio Sputnik.
Hard Facts is a show that gets to the heart of the matter. We question the mainstream media narrative to get to the truth about world affairs.
I don't think they have a clue what they're doing in Syria.
Basically, it's the sixth attempt by the big powers to overthrow a Middle East government.
Whether it is regime change, masked as revolution, imperialism masked as democracy and human rights. On Hard Facts, we peel back the layers to get to the real story other media doesn't want you to hear.
Absolutely astonishing the British government reacted to this case simply by lying.
Hard Facts.
We'll do one together, you ready? You ready? Max and Stacey together having oral sex. Here we go. 3, 2. Hi, Stacey.
Double down, double down.
I'm doubling down with you, baby.
Double down.
We got a new show on Sputnik.
It's markets, finance, business, economics, ka-ching, bling, and...
all kinds of good stuff. Only on Sputnik with Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert. Doubling down.
Mainstream news coverage catches the big moments.
60 people confirmed dead.
Brexit means Brexit.
We will make America great again.
But what about the stories behind the stories?
The untold stories hidden beneath the mainstream.
Several hundred guys on voluntary starvation.
Intelligence agencies cannot admit they make a mistake.
If they tell me back, I will kill myself.
Sputnik's daily global current affairs programme, World in Focus, with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Join us live from Sputnik Studios in Edinburgh, Scotland, every weekday from 4 p.m. in the UK, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time and 7 o'clock in Moscow.
Capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Ray Bradbury, the author of Fahrenheit 451, once wrote, "If you don't want a man unhappy politically, don't give him two sides to a question to worry him. Give him one. Better yet, give him none. Let him forget there's such a thing as war." Level Talk program has been devised to offer two sides to any argument. We don't want to make up your mind for you, but we do want to be sure that you know both sides of any story. Tune in to Level Talk.
Want to talk? Get in touch with us at radio@sputniknews.com.
This is Radio Sputnik.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, the rat-infested conditions in which 38,000 asylum seekers are housed in Britain have been branded as disgraceful by members of the UK Parliament. It's led to an influential Westminster committee calling for a major overhaul of the system. With just under 3 weeks to go until Ecuador's general elections, the first one at which the unprecedentedly popular President Rafael Correa will not be standing, today we'll be taking a look ahead at the runners and riders and what it all means for Ecuador. And online dating has found a new market, apparently. I'm yet to be convinced, but apparently now orangutans now have their very own Tinder. It's 38 minutes past the hour. The rat-infested conditions in which 38,000 asylum seekers are housed in Britain have been branded as disgraceful by members of the UK Parliament. It's led to the House of Commons Home Affairs Select Committee calling for a major overhaul of the system for housing destitute asylum seekers in Britain. It follows evidence of some families living in homes with infestations of mice, rats and bedbugs. For one torture survivor, the presence and noise of rats triggered flashbacks to the rat-infested cell where he had been detained and tortured. Liam O'Hare has more.
Well, this is not the first time that this issue has been raised, but it is the strongest statement so far from the influential Home Affairs Committee. And earlier I spoke to Robina Qureshi, who's director of the charity Positive Action for Housing, about the conditions that asylum seekers are housed in.
The rights that would be applicable to, maybe some people don't know, that the rights that are applicable to citizens of this country are not applicable to refugees and or asylum seekers in particular. So it means that they can be put out in the street and have their bags of clothes dumped on the street and with impunity, and nobody will say anything. We've had asylum seekers, people seeking refuge from Afghanistan, who have gone to complain to the asylum landlords about not having electricity or hot water, and being told by staff, well, you don't have electricity or hot water in Afghanistan, so why are you expecting it here? Basically insults being thrown at people who have nothing, who have lost everything, and being treated in a way that those staff know they can probably get away with, because it's their word against somebody who's seeking refuge. And a person who's seeking refuge in this country is probably not going to complain about the way that they're being treated. So I would say that this Westminster report, too little, too late. It's been going on for decades. This is not a new problem that suddenly Westminster has suddenly found out about. Yet another report to make somebody feel good, perhaps. But the bottom line is this has been going on for years. And when you come across and you have reports from clients telling us this is how they were spoken to, it shows us that people can, within these asylum landlords, Orchard Shipman, the rest of them, were behaving with impunity towards our clients because they could get away with it. And the Home Office did very little about it. And when we took up very, very serious cases with the Home Office about incidents that had happened to clients of ours as a result of health and safety, alleged health and safety breaches by the asylum landlords in the past, we never got an adequate response. We were dealing with a lot of cases, but we never got a proper response. We would chase it up and put pressure on. We were never told anything. We were always told that that was a contract between the Home Office and the so-called private landlord.
And is this a problem to do with private outsourcing as well, that the government is outsourcing this to various companies whose maybe sole or main motivation is making a profit?
Absolutely. Wherever you have a situation, whether it's in health, education, whether it's in housing, and certainly in this case, where there's such vulnerable people, where private landlords have got to skim off their profit, and what they will do is treat refugees, the most vulnerable in our society, in the worst possible ways to extract the profit that they wish to have. Whereas if the contract had been between the Home Office dealing with vulnerable people and, let's say, Scottish housing associations or housing associations across the UK, I don't think you'd have had one-tenth of the problems that have been highlighted right now, because housing associations are regulated, local authority housing where it's available is regulated, and they have certain procedures that they need to follow through. And therefore, we would have been in a much better position. But the government intended that people would be treated in a tortuous way under the asylum process, and that they would be treated in a way that's less than human, to make them feel bad enough, depressed enough, to think about returning. What they don't get is that when someone's seeking refuge and leaves their family, their home, their country behind, they're leaving for very good, sound reasons. They can't stay where they are, and they're not just going to easily just go back to something that they don't know. And people have ended up being destitute for years, months and years, and we are now operating a programme, not just in Scotland, but also across the UK now, to host refugees. And in the last 12 to 18 months, we've provided over 25,000 nights of shelter for refugees who were at risk of destitution or were destitute, so that they would not be left in the streets, so that they could have time to gather themselves and prepare the evidence for their cases, so they could submit, you know, judicial reviews or fresh asylum claims, because once the Home Office refuses them, they will proceed to make them destitute. And at that point is when our kind of service, our emergency service, comes into play. And when that happens, at some point, you know, almost every refugee will come and tell you, once they got leave to remain, that at some point the system had made them destitute. So that just kind of shows you how unfair the system is against genuine would-be refugees.
And just lastly, obviously, this is something that has been going on for a number of years. Obviously, your organisation has been at the forefront of trying to help refugees and asylum seekers in terms of housing. Are you now encouraged that this does seem to be getting looked at, that the spotlight is becoming more on it, especially in light of the Westminster report?
I'll be absolutely honest with you. I have no trust in the Home Office, absolutely no trust in the current government, particularly given the whole, how Theresa May shamed this country in front of the so-called US president, behaving like a, you know, a poodle of his, and not condemning him outright about the Muslim ban. You can see the state, how far right this country has gone when you see that kind of behaviour from a British Prime Minister, canoodling up to a man who's actually been compared to Hitler now because of the way that he is scapegoating and discriminating and giving a green light to every racist and fascist network and individual out there. So you can see what's happening. I have no faith in this report. I have no faith in the British government's ability to resolve this. Change is needed, and it probably will come from the people, I think, because more and more people are angry about the way the government is treating those who are in need, whether they're refugees, immigrants, Muslims, and more people are beginning to see exactly how it's going to be and how it has been for people in these categories. We're being treated, you know, I can't travel. I needed to travel for work reasons to develop the refugee hosting program in New York or Washington. I can't travel to do that. I can't travel because I'm a Muslim. That should maybe kind of give an indication of what the situation is right now. Our rights are being taken away from us in front of our eyes. This is not something that impacts them, and them is actually us. And if we're not helped, the next time it will be somebody closer to home, and then closer to home, and there'll be nobody speaking up for anybody.
Well, Rubina Qureshi, we very much appreciate your time today. Thanks for joining us on World in Focus.
Thank you.
It's just coming up for 46 minutes past the hour. In just 20 days' time, Ecuador goes to the polls in a general election. On Sunday, February the 19th, the South American country will elect a new president and National Assembly, as well as voting in a referendum on whether or not to ban politicians and civil servants from having bank accounts or companies based in tax havens. So with just under 3 weeks to go, we thought we'd take some time away from the likes of Donald Trump and Brexit to take a look at an election that will likely pass most of the world's media by. Ecuador's outgoing president, Rafael Correa, has held the job since 2007, and were it not for the term limits imposed on his office, he'd possibly be standing again this year, and he'd more than likely win. In fact, his supporters had been campaigning for a constitutional amendment under the banner Rafael Contigo Siempre, Always With You, Rafael. And whilst well over the required signatures were collected in order to hold a referendum, Correa announced that he would be retiring from politics and wouldn't run again. Correa's former vice president, though, and fellow member of the Socialist PAIS alliance, Lenin Moreno, is the favourite by far to win the election, according to recent polling. Lenin Moreno was vice president of Ecuador from 2007 to 2013, serving under President Rafael Correa. A shooting in 1998 left him paralysed, and as a paraplegic, Moreno was one of the world's few disabled national leaders. For his work as special envoy on disability and accessibility at the United Nations, he was nominated for the 2012 Nobel Peace Prize. His running mate in the election is Jorge Glass, the current vice president of Ecuador. Supporters of the outgoing President Correa see his time in office as a leftist citizens' revolution, and Ecuador's left wing is likely to remain in power after February 19th. Although Moreno is expected to win, even without the need for a runoff round, he still faces some competition. Polling at around 11% behind Lenin Moreno in second place is Guillermo Lasso for the centre-right CREO Creo Party.
Vamos por el cambio. Lasso presidente.
Established in 2012 and generally considered a centre right conservative outfit, Creo, or Creando Oportunidades, Creating Opportunities, operates on a centrist platform with an economic development model that's fairly market-oriented, favouring entrepreneurship. Guillermo Lasso is an Ecuadorian businessman and the largest shareholder in the Ecuadorian bank Banco de Guayaquil. His campaign's theme is one of change, and listening to his campaign ads and speeches, you'd be hard-pushed to miss his oft-repeated pledge to create 1 million more jobs in Ecuador. Un millón de empleo.
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 Vamos por el millón de empleos.
Vamos por el cambio.
Guillermo Lasso is currently polling at around 22.9%, a good 11 points behind the frontrunner Moreno. That's according to polling by Citados from last week. Behind Lasso, at another 11 points or so, is Cynthia Viteri.
Ya toca un cambio positivo.
Maya, todititito a las 6.
Cynthia Viteri is a lawyer and former newsreader on Ecuador's Telecentro, and she's held public office in the country since the 1990s under the banner of the centre-right Social Christian Party. But she's polling pretty low in third place. So, barring something pretty extraordinary happening over the next few weeks, Cynthia Viteri is highly unlikely to be the next president of Ecuador. That said, she's not the least likely candidate on the ballot. Presenting his campaign as a new force for change, polling at a 3% is Fuerza Ecuador's Dalo Bucaram.
Una nueva fuerza del cambio. Vamos con fe.
Dalo y Ramiro, presidente.
Publicidad electoral. Dalo Bucaram is a lawyer who's been at the National Assembly since 2009. Politics is, of course, his second career, his first being that of a professional footballer. Dalo is also the son of former president of Ecuador, Abdalla Bucaram Ortiz, the somewhat shady president who held office for a mere 6 months before being declared mentally unfit by the National Congress in 1997. But it's not just a new president that will be elected on February 19th. So too, Ecuador votes on a new National Assembly and a referendum on whether or not to ban politicians and civil servants from having bank accounts or companies based in tax havens. The question on the ballot will be, quote, do you agree that for those holding a popular elected office or for public servants, there should be a prohibition on holding assets or capital of any nature in tax havens? All in all, a busy day of voting awaits the electorate in Ecuador in just under 3 weeks' time. With me on the line now from Missouri to hopefully help us understand all of this a little bit better is Dr. Mark Becker, a professor of Latin American history at Truman State University. Thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Becker. Now, obviously the headline for these upcoming elections is that Rafael Correa's preferred successor looks almost certain to win the presidency. So placing that to one side for a moment, are there any surprises in store?
I'm a historian. I don't make predictions for the future. The latest polls that I've seen indicate that it's going to be fairly close of a vote. Lenin Moreno, Correa's successor, is far out in the lead. But this election is not that different from the elections that Ecuador's had since the return to constitutional rule in 1979 in their multi-party elections. I think this time are there 8 people running. And so Correa's second and third elections, he won an outright majority of the vote. Mm. And that is the only time in Ecuador's history. It's rare throughout Latin America. And the way the Constitution is written, a candidate either has to win an outright majority like Correa did, or you have to win 40% of the vote and 10% ahead of everybody else. And that 40% threshold is going to be the question. It appears that Moreno is going to have be 10% ahead of the second and third place candidates, both conservative. But whether he meets that 40% threshold is the unknown here.
To avoid it going into a runoff.
To avoid a runoff, yes.
It's also quite significant that Correa has remained president for as long as he has when you compare him to previous administrations in Ecuador.
Yeah, it's by far the longest presidency. Sometimes people complain about Latin America. Well, I guess there's two complaints, that either people come into power and never leave, or that there's frequent changes of power holders. And Ecuador is one of those countries where it's rare for somebody to be elected and actually complete a 4-year term of office. Throughout the 20th century, there were only 3 periods. Back in the 20s and the 50s and then the 80s and 90s, where you had a sequence of people completing their constitutionally designated terms of office. I think next to Bolivia, Ecuador probably holds the record for the highest number of chief executives, very frequent changes of power. And so maybe it's a double-edged sword. People complain when there's frequent changes of power, and then people complain when there's political stability. But this level of political stability was unprecedented for Ecuador.
Well, somewhat connected to that is the fact that for some years the tide in terms of politics throughout Latin America has appeared to have been turning away from the left, for example, in Brazil, Argentina, and if not entirely in Venezuela, it's fair to say that the government is not exactly popular at the moment. Ecuador, though, seems to have held on as a kind of bastion of the left in Latin America. Why is that?
I think that each country in Latin America is different. And I know that there's this pattern of seeing these broader trends. And I think people are looking to Ecuador in order to see if there is a pattern, if Ecuador is going to establish, is going to be part of these broader regional swings. This is one way that people are looking at it, as if Ecuador is a plebiscite on the left turn in Latin America. And I think a better way of looking at it is treating each country separately rather than looking for regional generalizations. And one thing that you do see in Ecuador is that Correa has been successful in terms of following through on the promises of the left turn, in terms of like lowering poverty, of shrinking inequality, of improving the quality of people's lives. And so I think the success is directly related to the successes of his government.
It's obviously, yes, fair to say that each country is individual and you shouldn't generalize too much. It's a very large continent. However, it's also fair to say that left-wing countries in Latin America, especially in recent years, have relied on the support of neighboring countries in order to sustain that kind of wave towards the
left.
Yes,
in a way. I mean, particularly coming out of Venezuela, this whole like Bolivar and Dream of the United States of Latin America, ALBA, the counter neoliberal leftist alliance in terms of building these strong alliances. And in the last decade, there have been significant initiatives like UNASUR as a regional PAX, as a counter to the Organization of American States that counter U.S. domination of the region. I would say maybe more significant than those regional PACs in terms of explaining current political turns, though, are maybe economics. The collapse of the commodities boom has led to a drop in revenue, which makes it more difficult for governments to follow through on their promises. And that's another way that Ecuador is different than Venezuela, for example, that a lot of the social programs in Ecuador were not paid for through the commodity boom, but through a larger tax take. And so Correa was quite successful in terms of reducing tax evasions and increasing income from the taxes. And so those policies were making his social programs more successful.
Thank you very much for talking to us today, Dr. Mark Becker.
I'm happy to be with you. Thank you.
Dr. Mark Becker, Professor of Latin American History at Truman State University, on the line there from Missouri, speaking to us about the upcoming elections in Ecuador due on February the 19th.
And finally, a Dutch zoo has embraced the world of online dating. Not for the staff, but to help the orangutans find their perfect mate. Apparently, the orangutans will be given a touch screen to swipe through several potential mates until they find the right match. Once they pick their mate, they'll be flown in from other international zoos from places as far away as Singapore. Now, I don't know that much about Tinder or online dating. I'll be honest with you, I know more than I wish I did. But I'm not sure that human users have that much dedication to dating. That sounds a little bitter. I didn't write that script. That's all we have time for on this edition of World in Focus. Don't forget you can listen again to this and previous shows at sputniknews.com/radio. This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. In just a moment, we'll hand over to Washington, D.C. for Tom Hartman's show. Until tomorrow, from me, Jack Foster, goodbye.
We are talking
24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
You are listening.
We give you the most essential out of the endless information space.
Radio Sputnik, telling the untold.
Mainstream news coverage catches the big moments.
60 people confirmed dead.
Brexit means Brexit.
We will make America great again.
But what about the stories behind the stories?
The untold stories hidden beneath the mainstream.
Several hundred guys on voluntary starvation.
Intelligence agencies cannot admit they make a mistake.
If they tell me back, I will be killed myself.
Sputnik's daily global current affairs program, World in Focus, with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Join us live from Sputnik Studios in Edinburgh, Scotland, every weekday from 4 p.m. in the UK, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, and 7 o'clock in Moscow.
Hi, this is Max Kaiser for Double Down. New show on Sputnik with Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert. Everybody's doubling down. Central bankers are doubling down. Gambleaholics are doubling down. Everyone's doubling down. Why don't you double down? Right here at Sputnik with a new show called Double Down with Max and Stacey. Bye, y'all.
Capitalism is going through a spasm.
caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Ray Bradbury, the author of Fahrenheit 451, once wrote, "If you don't want a man unhappy politically, don't give him two sides to a question to worry him. Give him one. Better yet, give him none. Let him forget there's such a thing as war." Level Talk program has been devised to offer two sides to any argument. We don't want to make up your mind for you, but we do want to be sure that you know both sides of any story. Tune in to Level Talk.